2002 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents session number 241, Evolutionary Dynamics Among 19th and 20th Century Homo Sapiens, a Mormon Example. Noontime Comedy, performed by Edgar C. Snow.
A Mormon Example. I'm Dean Thompson, and I'm the chair. This is the most imposing title that I've ever had. I've never been a bishop or a stake president, or even though my name is Dean, I've never been one. But today I'm the chair. That's really awesome. I'm a retired biology teacher, and I love the title. I love Ed's title because it has Homo sapiens and evolutionary in it. And as a biology teacher, I argued with the brethren at the seminary for 30 years over that kind of stuff. Ed Snow is an attorney who defends the innocent and makes sure that the scoundrels get locked up. He's the author of Workmanship, Musings of Things Mormon, which is a collection of humorous columns written for the Association of Mormon Letters. And he is the humor editor of the Association's magazine, which is called Eriantum. And so, with that, here's Ed!
This essay will be published in volume one of a forthcoming two-volume Festschrift in honor of D. Michael Quinn, to be published by Farms. Whenever I visit my parents and our conversation stalls, there is one guaranteed way to rev it up again. All I have to do is mention the E word, evolution. It can even be as subtle as this. Mom, I just read an essay by Stephen Jay Gould, and he says evolution is a fact. Now, this may be a morbid thing to say, but just to give you an idea of what I'm talking about, if my father is ever asked to resurrect my mother on the morning of the first resurrection as a part of a priesthood ordinance, I think he could get the job done simply by whispering the word evolution over her grave. And then she'd immediately come forth, arguing her way out of the dirt. I am a big fan of Professor Gould's essays, God rest his soul, but this was not always the case. In fact, before and during my mission, I had been interested in disproving evolution, but I was just too plain stupid to understand the arguments. That's why I went to law school. Then one day I stumbled onto the book Faith of a Scientist by Henry Eyring. Brother Eyring gave me the helpful perspective that Genesis was not a scientific text, nor was it intended to be. He helped me understand that it is the job of science to explain how things work and the mechanics of how idiotic humans wreak havoc on this planet, whereas the job of religion is to explain who started it all and why God lets idiotic humans wreak havoc on this planet. Two additional matters finally got me more comfortable with accepting evolution as a valid model for explaining the current evidence of how life on Earth got the way it is today. The first item was seeing a little-known picture of James Talmadge standing with his arm around what I thought was initially J. Golden Kimball. Upon closer viewing of this picture and reading the caption, rather than around J. Golden Kimball, I realized that Talmadge had his arm around a pile of erect, reconstructed dinosaur bones. Second, through my own study of Mormon history, I have discovered significant evidence showing that Mormons themselves have evolved over time. And now I'd like to share with you some of my own discoveries, which I think will demonstrate the fact of Mormon evolution. I trust that the following random examples and samples will be self-explanatory and convincing. First, I'd like to talk about the evolution of 72-hour kits. Although not an official part of the LDS food storage program, 72-hour kits have been traditionally viewed by many Mormons as an important first step in preparing for every needful thing. Here, for instance, is a list of a few items typically found in the modern 72-hour kit. 1 gallon of freeze-dried water. Meals ready to eat, to be used for fuel or vermin control. 173 function knife. Trying each function provides hours of distraction from real life emergency. Hand cranked AM/FM radio / wheat grinder / pasta maker / badger trap. 37 boxes of Pop-Tarts. A Ronco pocket fisherman / sewing kit / thigh master / Floby. Caution, not all functions can be safely used at the same time. A Navy SEAL audio tape survival seminar. 8 cassettes, 12 hours total. A tape player and batteries. And finally, a 99-hour candle, not to be used in church-owned buildings. Compare this fully evolved list to the original list of items in the first primitive 72-hour kit developed by Porter Rockwell in 1850. And here are the items in his 72-hour kit. Bacon, beans, and biscuits. Beans are not to be used in church-owned buildings. Rockwell devised this early version of the 72-hour kit shortly after taking one of several baths in the year 1849. According to a recently discovered journal, unbeknownst to Brother Rockwell, he had been carrying a supply of bacon, beans, and biscuits around in his beard in a sufficient quantity to last one person approximately 3 days. Shortly after this discovery, he began marketing his, quote, beard chock full of bacon, beans, and biscuits, end quote. Then in 1852, shortly thereafter, Hosea Stout jumped on the bandwagon and published his groundbreaking preparedness recipe book entitled Hosea Stout's Hat, Saddle, Boot, and Other Leatherware Jerky Recipe Book. The development of the storage of the modern 72-hour kit in a backpack rather than in a beard can be traced to the gradual decline of facial hair among Mormon men and, in some cases, women. Next, I'd like to turn to the evolution of swimsuits among Mormons. The earliest swimsuits in use among Mormons before 1846 mirrored those of their Gentile contemporaries and consisted of what modern swimsuit historians have labeled the hydro suit or the water suit, also known as the birthday suit. And these suits were used primarily by Mormon boys at waterholes and rivers. Pioneers in early Utah rejected the hydro suit. By most accounts, they apparently did not distinguish between swimsuits and regular clothing, although tweed suits were generally disfavored as swimming wear. By the turn of the 19th century, swimwear among Mormons became more specialized and continued to follow national trends. A good example of post-frontier Mormon swimwear used by general authorities and their wives can be seen in a fascinating picture reproduced in William Slaughter's book, Life in Zion. In this group picture, you have several general authorities in their bathing suits with their wives, featuring J. Golden Kimball, George Albert Smith, James Talmadge, who for some inexplicable reason is actually smiling, and young Joseph Fielding Smith, who is evidently in desperate need of a nap. A confidential source informs me that after the date of this group picture of general authorities, church policy no longer allowed general authorities to be photographed in swimsuits. By the 1940s, however, the evolution of Mormon swimwear lagged 20 years behind national trends, at least respecting women's suits. For instance, up until about 1990, at BYU, a Mormon fashion trend-setting institution, women's swimsuits featured pants legs extending at least 2 inches below the derriere, often with sufficient material for the swimsuit pants legs to be cuffed. This style soon became labeled the Utah cut in order to differentiate it from the French cut style. After the removal of the pants leg from the swimsuit in 1990, one anonymous BYU official criticized the change, saying that if, quote, Brigham Young were alive today and took one good look at the evolution of Mormon women's swimwear over the last 100 years, he'd have a heart attack. Next, I'd like to turn our attention to the evolution of books and pamphlets among Mormons. Of course, Mormonism was in large part founded upon the publication of a book, the Book of Mormon. Soon thereafter, Parley Pratt and others began publishing books and pamphlets to spread the gospel. As strange as it may seem to Mormons today, several sources from the 19th century indicate that early Latter-day Saints actually read these books. And when given as gifts, there's even evidence to suggest that the recipients actually read them as well. In fact, the Church Museum of Art and History has several examples of books that show evidence of actually having been read. When Mormons on the whole stopped reading books is difficult to determine, but many specialists believe this evolution occurred during the videoization of the church in the early 1980s. With the exception of a few remaining readers of Signature and Farms book publications. There is some hope that this limited reading in Mormonism may continue and further evolve, as indicated by the following press releases from Farms and Signature Books promoting new books specially tailored for Mormon audience based upon and patterned after the multi-million-dollar selling books of the Prayer of Jabez, Breaking Through to the Blessed Life. And here's a quote from the Farms press release. Farms is pleased to announce the publication of Jabez's Chiastic Prayer in the Book of Mormon, a non-apologetic analysis. This book is a scholarly rather than a popular study of the man named Jabez in the Old Testament and his short prayer in First Chronicles. This 900-page publication will collect all known Hebrew, Aramaic, Greek, Syriac, Coptic, and Ethiopic versions of the Prayer of Jabez, reformatted in their original but unknown to Joseph Smith chiastic structures, and supplemented by excerpts from the Joseph Smith translation, as well as Prayer of Jabez fragments from the Dead Sea Scrolls, as well as non-biblical writings that mention prayers or Jabez from early Christian, Jewish, and Muslim traditions. Also in the press release, Nathaniel Patterson, who is the Associate Director of Research at Farms, is quoted as saying, "Interestingly, we have also found in our research an ancient Egyptian scroll that mentions a certain Jezeb, possibly confirming the existence of a man named Jabez, since it's highly likely that some ancient Egyptian scribes had problems with dyslexia." Signature Books has also announced the publication of a book about Jabez's prayer called Prayer of Jabez, Critical Explorations Concerning a Person Purporting to Be a Man Named Jabez and His Dubious Claims to Answered Prayer, edited by Brant Kaffmit. This book is solely available as a part of a limited leather edition that's too expensive for anyone to buy. According to Kaffmit, quote, "Jabez appears to have been a proto-feminist, polyandrous lesbian, intellectual, who held the matriarchal priesthood of the Queen of Heaven, served in King David's court, and wrote the Book of Jay, as is amply demonstrated in this new translation and collection of essays about this interesting, but obviously non-historical and non-chiastic biblical text." And finally, I'd like to now turn our attention, well, actually there are two more items. First, Mormon kitsch, the evolution of Mormon kitsch. In the early days of the church, if you didn't count books or Mormon scriptures or Mormon newspapers, the only specifically Mormon merchandise appears to have been Seer stones and Adam's Far West altar stones. And there wasn't exactly a large market for them either. This static situation continued for the longest time, and even witnessed a decline in seer stone and altar stone production and exchange in the early part of the 20th century. However, beginning in the late 1970s and continuing through the late 1990s, Mormon kitsch started to evolve at an unbelievable rate. In order to put this all into perspective, compare these primitive seer stones and altar stones of days gone by with the following currently marketed Mormon gift items and their product descriptions. First, the Trevor Southey dinner placemats. Who says artistic nudity can't be enjoyed at dinner time? Now you can serve meals with an aesthetic message. Children can learn their body parts as they wait for casseroles and also ponder the meanings of Southey's enigmatic floral symbology. Next, the Calvin Grundle Sacrament Meeting program covers. Still looking for a way to magnify your calling as the ward sacrament meeting program person? Now is your chance with these whimsically inspired and inspiring cartoon program covers. Each one has a theological theme that can be easily tied to sacrament meeting topics. Next, the Minerva Tykert lunchboxes. Do you need birthday gifts for primary children? Kids of all ages love these colorful renditions of Book of Mormon events by muralist Minerva Tykert, now in portable lunchbox format. Does not include thermos. Included with the first 1,000 orders is a package of Arnold Freeburg Book of Mormon character puffy stickers. Kids love stickers. Next, and this is published, or this is produced by the Franklin Covey Mint. This is the Urim and Thummim with detachable breastplate date planner. Set beautifully in a silver-plated bow attached to an oversized copper breastplate-shaped day planner are two lead crystals that feature LCD messages for you and your family, such as, don't forget to do your home teaching, among others. Stones also glow in the dark or in hats. Batteries not included. Next, we have the Ammon Disarming Lamanites Piggy Bank. This porcelain-covered die-cast metal piggy bank is a great way for youngsters to save money for a mission. As each coin is inserted into the bank, Ammon strikes 7 blows, literally disarming his Lamanite foes. Complementing the visual effects of this wonderful piggy bank is a special embedded computer chip technology that adds audio effects that rival the Hill-Cumorah pageant itself. One other item, and this is, of course, going to be a favorite to any BYU alum, is the Steve/Brigham Young, This Is the Place/In-Your-Face Touchdown Pass figurine. Patterned after the design of the character Two-Face in Batman comics and movies, one half of this porcelain figurine features Brigham Young, his arm outstretched towards Utah, while the other half depicts Brother Brigham's great-great-grandson poised to hurl a 49er pass. Next, we have the Belshazzar Smiting Knees Lamp. Every time your young boy turns on the light, he will be vividly reminded of the consequences of wine, women, and song. Flip the light switch, and the king's loins are loosed, and his knees smite together as the following message is backlit on the wall. Many, many tekel a parson. There is no accompanying translation. Next, we have the Gerald and Sandra Tanner Pioneer figurine. This Iyardo-quality porcelain figurine features Gerald and Sandra Tanner, those endearing anti-Mormon pioneers, pulling a handcart piled high with their many groundbreaking publications. Next, we have a Change to the Book of Mormon a Day calendar. This is perfect for that anti-Mormon in your family who has everything. This handy 15-year calendar displays a different change per day from the original Book of Mormon printed by Mr. Grandin in 1830. This is available also in BYU blue and white. Also available in daytimer and planner formats. And finally, the Evolution of Mormon Kitsch, the Kinderhook Plates wallpaper. Line your anti-Mormon bookstore with this attractively designed Kinderhook Plates wallpaper, those little smiley faces on these forged artifacts, intended as a practical joke, will lift the spirits of even the most angry apostate customer. And now finally, I'd like to turn our attention to Mormon luggage. Only the most ardent anti-evolutionists question the fact that Mormon luggage has evolved over time. The first distinctively Mormon item in this category for our consideration is the handcart. Even handcarts themselves evolved during the few years in which they were in use. For instance, early models generally came in one design and had the following options. Wood. Later models carried options such as remote access, rack and pinion steering, and airbags. Later handcarts also came in a variety of models, many of which were modified by teenage pioneers, with the addition of flame decals, bumper stickers, and fuzzy dice. With the coming of the railroad, handcarts disappeared, of course, no longer fit to survive. The next evolutionary stage in the development of Mormon luggage came with the advent of the scripture tote bag. The first documented use of a recognizable modern tote bag appeared in 1973 in a Laurel class in Sandy, Utah. Sister Johansson Johnsonson transformed a worn-out gunny sack dress into a small bag to carry books to church with. Shortly thereafter, entrepreneurs in Utah began marketing similar tote bags through Deseret and other outlets. Today, consumers may purchase scripture tote bags from among the following variety of designs. The stewardess model, it has extendable metal handles and wheels at the base. It fits in all airplane overhead compartments. The Wild Wild West hip holster model, ideal for scripture chase and missionaries. The fanny pack model for soccer moms on the go. The standard works out model. Scriptures form the ends of a barbell for working out anywhere. And then there's the FBI shoulder holster model for carrying concealed scriptures. Now, there is one group that has recently contested the date of 1973 as the date for the modern, or actually the origins of scripture tote bags. They claim a much more ancient origin of scripture tote bags, and I'll read to you some excerpts from a news article that appeared in the Sugar Beet recently. It was called New Foundation Formed to Study the Ancient Origins of Scripture Tote Bags. Clark Kurzman, president of Scripture Luggage, Inc., the premier manufacturer of Mormon scripture tote bags, announced today the formation of a new Mormon research organization called the Foundation for Ancient Research on Toting Scriptures. At a press conference, Herzman explained that, quote, now more than ever, the use of scripture tote bags is under subtle and insidious attack by so-called intellectual and liberal Mormons. These liberals and intellectuals prefer to carry their scriptures rather than use the more traditional scripture tote bag, and frequently deride those who prefer pleatherette-handled bags for carrying their holy writ. The purpose of the foundation is to first demonstrate the antiquity of scripture tote bags, and second, to fully restore the former dignity of the venerable usage of tote bags. According to Martin Schlagel, the newly hired research director at the Foundation for Ancient Research on Toting Scriptures, tote bags were used by ancient Hebrews and scriptures and Christians. Quote, yes, the form of the scripture tote might have changed from dispensation to dispensation, but its function was never altered. Look at the big jars found with the Dead Sea Scrolls. We have significant archaeological evidence that these jars were actually used for carrying and storing scrolls. And don't forget the ancient Israelite practice of wearing phylacteries on the forehead. No one disputes that those headbands had a little pouch in the front specifically designed to carry scriptures. Hertzman ended the press conference noting that, quote, we also take this opportunity to request that when members of the press refer to the Foundation for Ancient Research on Toting Scriptures, they use the full name of our organization for the initial reference in a news story, and thereafter, if an abbreviated reference is necessary, that our foundation be simply referred to as the Foundation. Unlike other Mormon research foundations, such as Farms or Fair, we request that members of the press not use any acronyms in referring to the foundation. In conclusion, what is the future of Mormon evolution, you might ask? Stephen Gould was always annoyed when people asked him this question. He indicated that the question presupposes that evolution can be charted, as if evolution is a form of progression, a serious misunderstanding of the fossil record and the theory of evolution. I, on the other hand, am not annoyed and will gladly hazard some guesses with respect to some trends visible from my own personal life and from the examples I've noted here. First of all, I predict the following. 72-hour kits will no longer be recommended since I know that I will be able to carry my own portable fat supply and will be able to easily skip 9 meals covered by 72-hour kits based upon the evolution of my own waistline. Number two, swimsuits might actually be unnecessary for me as well, since you wouldn't even be able to see my swim trunks if my gut continues to evolve at its current rate. And finally, I may actually need a handcart myself, which may be renamed a posterior cart, to assist me in hauling my own rear end to church. Thanks.
Okay, we have about 5 minutes. He will entertain questions. No, really, if you have a question. Would you like to come up and speak into the mic?
I'll be embarrassed to say this in front of the mic. On your 72-hour kit, which is just great, I would like you to entertain the idea of adding my son-in-law's essential, which is a Frisbee, because you can eat cereal out of it, so forth. That was his main item.
Any others? Okay. Be it. That's all, folks.